Chapter 9. Che Neanderthal. Go soon, the wind whispers. It's time, roar the deer, their breath pluming in the cold air. Leave now, says the dawn frost, burning its message into the grass. The people listen. Shadows inside the rock shelter grow colder. Hard skin forms on puddles. Their hunting trips shrink, taking only what's close by, knowing they will soon leave. A last deer gives itself up, is taken in to be unmade right there next to the fires. Cranes flap overhead like scraps of summer chasing the sun. Half the deer is eaten. Soon, drips from the roof edge will harden into icy fingers. A morning of excitement, a dangling fluffy catch, tail ringed like the path of a stone through water. They turn its wide claw pads over to know it, snag fang tips with their thumbs, stroke long whiskers. Cat. An animal more dreamed than seen, it is the last message, the last meal. With a final fire, they suck its fat into their cheeks, roll and pack its deep furred pelt. Then, the people haul themselves up, begin walking. Their noise fades to silence. The rock shelter exhales. Time spins up and begins to defocus. Thrushes come to scratch at ashes, cocking their heads. Rabbits blur inwards and outwards as a falcon swoops down. It stays to winter under the overhang. Below its blade-sharp gaze, the wildcat's body settles into the earth. Membranes and guts ripple with the maggot dance beneath. Blanketed by last year's leaves, only furry gnawers bother the summer-dried bones. As trees flare from green to yellow to orange, the people return. Just as the old ones foretold, the floor has become too wet for fires and the rock shelter will welcome no more dwellers. They depart, leaving roots and mosses to embroider the edges of bone heaps. The years flow past as limestone-filtered waters seep and rise around the wildcat skeleton. The deer, the wood, the ashes, the stones. The sleeping time has come. Place is solid. But time is the wisp in archaeologists' fingers, disappearing just as we try to grasp it. The incredible details now amassed about Neanderthals are so far beyond the dreams of pioneer prehistorians, they verge on science fiction. Yet, fully reconstructing the rich tapestry of their lives, seeing not just the threads but the weave, is formidably hard. Phenomena like lithic technocomplexes are visible at geological timescales, yet require explanations operating at human ones. And for a long time, research has foundered in the quicksand of deep time, the connections between things out of reach without knowing how old they were. The advent of direct dating methods was transformational, but just as important has been better understanding of how time creates sites. A vital baseline in trying to understand what any particular site means for Neanderthal behaviour is both what they did and how long they spent there. However, even with super accurate dating methods applicable to minuscule samples, in the vast majority of locales, it's not possible to distinguish occupation phases shorter than a millennium, never mind a century. That's because an archaeological layer can swallow up surprising amounts of time. Sediments separating different deposits of artifacts can erode or slip away, leaving a mixed mass of objects. In this way, a hand's breadth thickness may be a palimpsest of 1,000 summers. Remarkably, measuring the true number of occupations represented by particular layers has now become possible, in some circumstances. Pioneered at Mandrin Cave, southeast France, An ingenious method known as phylogenochronology is opening a window onto just how crammed full of time some Neanderthal sites are. Close inspection of odd black smudges within lumps of carbonate, a mineral deposit growing on walls and ceilings, revealed nanoscale stripes. Essentially, tiny stratigraphies written in soot. They formed when the fires of Neanderthals in residence smoked the roof and walls, leaving thin soot films. If nobody was there, plain carbonate sealed them over. Then the cycle repeated and layers built up. Just like barcodes, they're unique, allowing pattern matching between different chunks within and between layers. This sooty archive provides the only known means of counting the minimum number of times Neanderthals stayed during reasonably thick archaeological layers, and the results are startling. One 50 centimetre or 20 inch thick level at Mandrin Cave covers at least 8 periods of occupation, already quite a large number. But the level below, of about equal thickness, represents up to 80 occupations. It's a stark warning that the appearance of layers can be deceptive, and a reminder that more than 99% of all the assemblages archaeologists study aren't from single occupations, but represent patterns of behaviour over at least one, if not many, generations. Time-averaged assemblages like that are far from useless, but to understand them better, we need to discern the minutiae of Neanderthal life. To make the ideal archaeological site, you need high-definition conditions that prevent lithics and bones from different occupations blurring together. Fine sediment that accumulates rapidly but gently and remains uneroded is perfect. Such locales are precious not only because they represent brief phases in time, but also because, if undisturbed, they preserve spatial patterns revealing what Neanderthals were doing in different parts of the site. The Rosetta Stone for deciphering the wider archaeological record of the Neanderthals has always been finding single episodes of action or presence, ideally lasting just a few days or even minutes. Individual refitted groups of lithics, of course, represent very short timescales, but finding a whole layer at the same temporal resolution is almost unheard of. Yet, thanks to 21st century excavation methods, we know they do exist. To study these kinds of places, modern technology as well as infinite patience is vital. Lasers record object positions in 3D, providing data to digitally reconstruct the vertical or horizontal spreads of artifacts. Details such as lithic clusters around hearths or microlayers invisible during digging emerge on screen. A key approach is to look for special things, unusual stones or rare animal species that stand out like a UV glow against masses of other fragments. Combined with refitting and microscopic sediment analysis, today we are as close as we may ever get to being able to watch Neanderthals going about their daily lives. Chapter 7 explored the wooden artefacts of Abrik-Romani, but the exceptional conditions of preservation there also show in stunning detail how Neanderthals used space in between periods when the rock shelter was too wet to live in. After they left, fresh travertine flows entombed the entire abandoned living surface, preserving everything just where it lay. The timescale for each archaeological layer is certainly more than a few days, but is likely to represent decades rather than many centuries. Excavations have now reached level R, some 60,000 years old, and it'll take many years for this material to be studied. But analysis of younger levels from M to P, dug up a decade ago, have already produced amazing results. Level O, dating around 55 to 54,000 years ago, contains one of the most high-definition records of Neanderthal life in the world. From sediments covering the 270-metre square or 320-yard square surface of the rock shelter, but under 1 metre or 3 feet. From sediments covering the 270-metre or 320-yard square surface of the rock shelter, but under 1 metre or 3 feet thick, some 40,000 objects were excavated. Digital analysis of their positions clearly shows at least 3 major phases, although each is probably made up of more than one occupation. Magnetic data from hearth sediments indicates that everything formed within just a few centuries, so each phase is likely to represent Neanderthals coming and going over a few generations at most. The middle phase, OB, is the richest and contained a completely unique discovery, a whole butchered wildcat. Through every level at Abrik-Romani, Neanderthals normally smashed up bones so systematically that picking out individual creatures is almost impossible. To find a mostly complete skeleton is extraordinarily unusual and points to a very brief snapshot in time just before the site was abandoned and another travertine layer built up. The last Neanderthals to live there for many centuries caught and skinned the cat, probably cooking it on a nearby burned area. Bellies full, they were already thinking ahead. Missing toe tips and tail bones show that they took the thick, striped pelt onwards with them. Where the hearth is. The wildcat is an astounding find, representing no more than a morning or afternoon more than 50 millennia ago. Even in high-definition places like Abrik-Romani, the typical layers are still tricky. How is it possible to separate overlapping vestiges of activity from within the dense spreads of artifacts and bone fragments? The answer is to begin at the heart and spiral outwards. A black carbon molecule, an incandescent ember, an ashy aureole, a lattice of branches. A circle of eyes glowing in the dark. Hearths are archaeological touchstones. They lie at the centre where the warp of time and weft of space connect. Like beacons shining through the fog of millennia and confusing haze of data, they offer anchor points precisely because they were also the cause for Neanderthal life. Fire is one of the most potent symbols in the grand story of human evolution. It gives light and heat, but so much more, protecting against predators, cooking food and transforming other substances. It even extends social life by banishing the darkness. Just as our houses have been built around fires throughout history, hearths also structured Neanderthal existence, an instantly recognisable centering of space. We don't need to imagine them sitting face to face. We can literally see it in the way artifacts encircle the ashes and charcoal. Charcoal fragments, burned artifacts and heated sediments are found across hundreds of sites. But exploring what they mean is challenging. Fireplaces are fugitive artifacts, their structures as fragile as the ash inside them. They can be smeared or obliterated through erosion, trampling or distortion by overlying layers. Experimental studies show that sometimes heated sediments survive where other fire evidence does not, and microlayers from different burning phases are especially strong evidence of hominin action. A key locale that has developed our knowledge of Neanderthal pyrotechnology is El Salt, Alicante. This rock shelter is about 350 kilometres or 220 miles south of Abrik-Romani and, as well as being broadly contemporary in age, has hosted a similarly decades-long project. As excavation began to show black circles that looked like hearths, researchers wanted to try and better understand what these features were. Creating experimental hearths right by the limestone cliffs allowed them to closely match conditions to those the Neanderthals of El Salt experienced. They found that fresh hearths typically show a triple layer structure, heat-reddened soils at the base, then a black layer topped by ashes from the burned fuel. In many archaeological sites, the ash layer has disappeared due to natural processes, which was often the case at El Salt. The black layers they had excavated were therefore charred remnants of whatever had been on the floor beneath the fire, confirmed by microscopic analysis as essentially weeds and leaf litter. Therefore, any artefacts in those black layers are more likely to be from older occupations. Despite advances in identifying hearths, Neanderthal pyrotechnical skills remain hotly contested. Nobody today denies they used fire, as hominins have for over a million years, and hearths undeniably become more common through the course of the Middle Paleolithic. From about 120,000 years ago, fire was obviously part of everyday life. But the question of whether Neanderthals simply scavenged it or could produce it is, perhaps surprisingly, still debated. The problem is that some sites exist with relatively rich archaeology, but the presence of fire is barely detectable. What's more, the most often cited cases are Roc de Marsal and Pêche de Lazay 4, southwest France, where keener layers really stick out as lacking hearths or even much charcoal, despite their presence in earlier periods. Given that the layers date to the MIS4 glacial, the apparent lack of fire right when it was coldest is puzzling. Is it possible Neanderthals could use fire once they had it, but had forgotten or never knew how to make it? Theories that they simply toughed it out with thicker clothing and raw diets not only seem unlikely, they're also contradicted by the presence of some charcoal and burned lithics and bone, albeit far rarer than in other layers at the same sites. Perhaps Neanderthals were just scavenging fire from natural blazes. However, in high-latitude tundra environments, like those when the hearthless layers accumulated at Pêche de Lazay 4 and Roc de Marsal, lightning strikes are very uncommon. If wildfires were extremely intermittent, then Neanderthals would need to be exceptionally good at conserving embers, in which case they could just as easily have daisy-chained flames from one hearth to another. There's another explanation for all this. Maybe Neanderthals were perfectly able to make fire at will, but simply changed how and where they used it, according to different ways of living. If, during the keener phases, they tended to make hearths just outside caves, there would be no trace inside, except for a bit of charcoal and a few burned remains, exactly what's found. Paleopyrotechnics. Whether or not fire on demand was universal among all Neanderthals, birch tar technology strongly argues this was the case for many populations from at least 300,000 years ago. Precisely what their blaze-starting skills consisted of is less certain, but being curious, inventive, and surrounded by napping, at least some Neanderthals must have noticed how struck flint gets hot and creates natural sparks. For a long time, archaeologists found virtually no special striker-light tools, but it now appears that they were simply being economical. In some sites, up to 75% of bifaces show battering in the centre of one or both faces. Microscopic study and experiments show that they formed when either another flint or potentially iron pyrite, both known to produce sparks, struck at an angle and then dragged along the biface's long axis. More complex methods might also have been practiced. Just as you speed up your barbecue by using chemical firelighters, new research suggests that Neanderthals may have done something similar. Manganese dioxide is a deep black-coloured mineral naturally found in small concentrations at many sites. But some locales have exceptionally large amounts, for example, up to 1 kilogram or 2.2 pounds worth across several layers at Pêche de Lazay 1. When examined closely, many of the hundreds of small pieces here and in other sites had been rubbed. Furthermore, occasional finds of limestone blocks with remnants of black powder point to Neanderthals sometimes grinding manganese. One explanation comes from the fact that this mineral has pigment properties that we'll explore later. However, it's also a great fire accelerant, especially when powdered, making wood catch a light faster and burn more efficiently. As yet, there's no direct evidence that Neanderthals did use manganese this way, but it's an intriguing possibility. Once alight, Neanderthals were interested in carefully managing their fires. The majority appear like simple campfires. Flat, circular deposits of charred material and ash functioning well enough without surrounding stones. But sometimes Neanderthals invested in constructing hearth features. At Abric Romani and Roca dels Baus, another rock shelter not far away, they chose to kindle fires within natural hollows, improving the heat retention. In some cases, they deepened these first, and most impressively in level O at Abric Romani, Neanderthals were controlling airflow into pit hearths by digging small trenches. It's probably no coincidence that in well-preserved sites like this, there's also more evidence that stone blocks or cobbles were placed by fires, probably helping to avoid drafts or direct heat. Given what we know about Neanderthals' material choices for artifacts, it's not surprising that they also took care in the fuels they used. Wood is by far the most common, and similar to how they hunted, largely they took whatever was around. Being very abundant, pine is therefore the most commonly burned wood, but sometimes it seems to have been selected despite other species being available. For example, in level J of Abric Romani, among over 1,000 identified charcoal fragments, all but one were pine, the exception being birch. El Salt has a more diverse pattern, potentially linked to its local environment, which was milder and more varied. In addition to pine and juniper, there's maple, evergreen oak, and even yew. But interestingly, the species vary between different hearths. This is particularly visible in Unit 10, where among mostly pine-fueled hearths, maple was much less common or widespread. And even rarer oak and boxwood seem to have been burned only in a couple of fires. Concentrations like this probably reflect Neanderthals staying for short periods, but it's difficult to know if the species choice was deliberate. The length of time Neanderthals stayed in any place would have affected how they used fuel. The Abric del Pastor rock shelter in southeast Iberia is over 800 metres or 2,600 feet up in the mountains, and pine wasn't as abundant in the cool, dry climate. Most of the remains in hearths are juniper and terebinth, or mastic wood. Slow-growing juniper has very twiggy, tough branches and produces little deadwood, meaning that collecting it is difficult. Terebinth is also less suitable than pine and would have made a heady smoke. It's likely that Neanderthals only switched to burning these species after using up the limited local stocks of pine, suggesting that at least sometimes they were living at Abric del Pastor for more than a couple of nights. What Neanderthals do seem to have been picky about is the type of wood they burned. Where studies have been done, microscopic features as well as the small size of twigs and branches point to naturally fallen or dead wood being the most common fuel, rather than freshly felled greenwood. It's easier to collect, burns better, especially if resin-rich like pine, and especially suits cooking. Forests in their natural state generally have abundant deadwood, and by walking just a kilometre, Neanderthals could find enough to fuel multiple small fires for up to 6 months. This means that unless they were staying for significant periods of time, cutting fresh wood made little sense, and daily foraging would be enough. Exactly what's seen in hunter-gatherers who don't stockpile. On the other hand, some high-latitude indigenous communities, including Athabascan and Yupik peoples in Alaska and Itelmen in Kamchatka, Russia, will drag entire standing dead or recently fallen trees back if they encounter them while out and about. At Abrik-Romani, Neanderthals did bring some larger branches to hearths, and there may even be evidence of a woodpile of sorts in front of the rock shelter in level M. As we'll see in the next chapter, levels N and OA contain entire tree trunks. But whether they were hauled in for fuel or something else is less clear. A most unexpected fuel for Neanderthal hearths is coal. Already mentioned in Chapter 8 as having excellent evidence of rabbit hunting, the Les Canalettes rock shelter is also unusual because Neanderthals there were burning brown coal. It wasn't a case of glacial wood shortages, since the coal is most abundant in hearths during phases when warm-loving species like elm, maple, and walnut grew locally. There's another possibility. Neanderthals were intentionally experimenting with fossil fuels. Brown coal isn't easy to spark, but once alight, it burns low, hot, and even. Adding 500 grams or 1.1 pound to wood embers will dramatically prolong a fire's life. How would they discover the coal in the first place? Perhaps simply by paying attention to what washed up at the edges of rivers, where they sourced a lot of the stone they napped. The closest brown coal deposits to Les Canalettes are about 10 to 15 kilometres or 6 to 10 miles north, at the confluence of two deep river gorges, and it's highly likely that Neanderthals came across eroded nodules. Being ultimately of a woody origin, it would have combined familiar yet strange properties, tempting curious investigation and realisation of its usefulness. Most fascinating, brown coal was burned through the multiple occupations at Les Canalettes, representing at least many centuries, if not millennia. Either Neanderthals repeatedly discovered it, or there was a long-lived tradition. Whichever the case, the peaty aroma of its smoke would have marked their stays there. A different, abundant material that has a similar improving effect for fires is bone. Although hard to get alight and quick to burn out, adding it will double the life of a wood-fueled fire, potentially a huge advantage in open tundra. Plenty of sites and hearths do contain burned bone, of course, but identifying whether Neanderthals used it as fuel is tricky. Sometimes what seems to be a bone fire turns out, with detailed analysis, to have a lot of wood too, preserved only as microscopic remnants or chemical traces. On the other hand, Neanderthals would have lived with one eye constantly on their fires, and since, as we'll return to later, they sometimes burned butchery waste, it's likely they noticed that bone could make the flames last longer. Creating a blaze required skill, but Neanderthals also had to maintain the flames, especially as there's more than one kind of fire. Across many hunter-gatherer societies, there's a spectrum in how fire is used. Big open-air blazes for protection, pit fires for roasting, small cooking fires, hide-smoking fires, sleeping hearths for warmth, even anti-insect smudge fires. Neanderthal sites show a strikingly close match to the variety in ethnographic data. The smallest fires are just 20 to 30 centimetres or 8 to 12 inches across and often seen temporary, potentially kindled for a single day or even one task. They're visible as individual circles of charcoal and ash in some places like Abrik-Romani, but in sites without high-definition preservation, they're blurred by time into thick charcoal and ash layers, speckled by tiny burned bones and lithics. Yet Neanderthals also made larger, more permanent hearths. At Abrik-Romani, sizable combustion zones, 1 metre or 1.1 yard or more across, have been excavated. And being surrounded by masses of lithic and faunal debris were obviously the focus for activities over many days or even weeks. It's not just about size either. When tiny bone fragments from inside hearths are examined, their varied colour and condition reflect burning at quite dissimilar intensities. Some hearths only smouldered below 300 degrees centigrade, while others blazed at over 750 degrees centigrade. Some of the lower temperature examples look a lot like ethnographic sleeping fires. Small and located close to back walls, their heat reflecting off stone to keep slumbering Neanderthals cosy. It's even possible to see how individual fires were sometimes used in diverse ways. Microscopic analysis showed that one shallow pit hearth at Abercromarny had sometimes burned freely, but at other times appears to have been banked down, leading to lower oxygen concentrations. Occasionally, there are hints about the kinds of tasks certain hearths were involved in. Back in Unit 10 at El Salt, quite a lot of the maple wood being burned was rotten. Fully decaying timber, beyond deadwood, is a poor choice of fuel unless you're after a lot of smoke. Supporting the possibility that Neanderthals had deliberately chosen it are over 200 fragments of maple seeds, most likely from fresh branches. Although technically edible, burning leafy branches would certainly have boosted the hearth's smokiness, perfect for curing hides. So far, we've only thought about Neanderthals using fire at particular locales, but there's another possibility. Many hunter-gatherers use fire as a different kind of tool out in the landscape, sometimes to communicate, other times on a larger scale. Mimicking wildfires, they can drive animals and even manage the environment, since burning opens up vegetation, forcing new growth that's a magnet for herbivores. There just might be hints of this among Eemian forest-dwelling Neanderthals, precisely when we might expect to see this kind of behaviour. In the Neumark-Nord sediments, just as Neanderthal lithics become visible, there's a sharp spike in charcoal particles, 10 times background levels. The pollen shows more sun-loving species too, like blackthorn and hazel. Something was opening up the forest. What's difficult to tell is whether this was natural burning, creating a landscape attractive to Neanderthals, or if they were the fire starters. It's clear, however, that there's a connection, since the pattern lasts for 2 to 3 millennia. Then, as their archaeology disappears, so the forest begins closing in again. Burning time. Hearths have more to tell. Prehistorians' desire to gain the highest possible definition in assemblages has always come up against the question of layers with many hearths. Through level O at Abercromarny, for example, there are 60. Did Neanderthals have more than one active fire at a time, or do they reflect amalgamations of separate phases? This is not an abstract musing, since one of the biggest uncertainties in our knowledge of Neanderthals is the size of groups they lived in. And multiple, synchronous hearths implies larger groups. Stratigraphy is key to finding out. If hearths overlap vertically, they were obviously used at different times. However, if they seem to be at roughly the same level but are spread out horizontally, the problem gets gnarlier. The solution is analysis of the surrounding spreads of objects, looking for refits or other connections between different hearths, especially in both directions. If many things moved back and forth, it's good evidence that those fires were active at the same time. Over the past decade, researchers have done this meticulous work across entire sites and managed to unpick palimpsests that would otherwise have been extremely hard to discern. Unit 10 at El Salt extends just 35 metres square, or 42 yards square, and is only 50 centimetres or 20 inches deep, but contains more than 80 hearths. By comparing the overlaps of hearths and refitting, it's been possible to separate out 8 distinct phases each just 1.5 centimetres or 0.5 inches or so thick. Combined with the rate of sedimentation, researchers have been able to reconstruct the cycles of history in this one layer to an astonishing degree. Neanderthals were coming to El Salt for just a few generations at most, then abandoning it entirely for several centuries before returning. Digitally hovering above the site, hearths appear and disappear in a slow heartbeat, pulsing as Neanderthals came and went over 1,000 years. And where hearths are widely spaced out, making it harder to identify their sequence, refitting artifacts back to individual stone nodules, known as raw material units or RMUs, means it's still possible to pick out individual napping phases. By plotting these spatially, researchers could see that the RMUs cluster around particular hearths and don't seem to connect them. Every hearth really does seem to be from a different occupation. The dissection went even further. Adding up all the RMUs and other isolated artifacts, tools made elsewhere and left at the site, or small flakes showing an artifact had been imported, resharpened, and then removed, produced a maximum possible number of events that could happen at each hearth. Being cautious, researchers counted each napping sequence and single tool as separate events, but that's certainly an overestimate. In reality, a Neanderthal would probably have sat and napped more than one stone block, creating several RMUs, and perhaps also left behind one or two blunted tools. Moreover, it's likely they didn't travel alone. Put together, this means that even if the average number of events per hearth is over 100, that's still probably no more than a few days' activity by very few Neanderthals. Some of the El Salt Unit 10 hearths had extremely low numbers of events, probably representing the remains of a single visit. For example, along with only 33 animal bones, one fire was associated with just 43 artifacts, comprising 8 RMU napping sets, 2 imported tools, and 11 flakes that must have come off course, which were then carried onwards. But the highest definition yet achieved for any Neanderthal site comes from another rock shelter less than 5 kilometres or 3 miles southwest. Since 2005, excavations at Abrec del Pastor have uncovered the entire 60-metre square or 70-yard square surface. So we can be sure no hearths are unaccounted for. In level 4, which is only 70 centimetres or 27 inches thick, at least 4 sub-levels contain more than one occupation phase. Crucially, some phases have minuscule assemblages clustered around a single fire. 4C1 even has more animal bone fragments, 95, than lithics, 22, which form just 6 RMUs. This particular phase looks exactly like the ephemeral trace of a few Neanderthals staying one night, doing a bit of napping, eating, then moving on. It's unlikely that we'll ever push past this level of definition in time, but beyond the frankly mind-blowing ability to see a single evening from more than 90,000 years ago, the full analysis from Abrec del Pastor provides an answer to the conundrum of whether multiple hearths mean one or more visits. When studied in detail using RMUs and 3D mapping, every level at Abrec del Pastor, with multiple fires, turned out to consist of individual phases, each with one hearth. This strongly suggests that it was only ever visited by very small groups of Neanderthals. But there's an exception. The lowest level yet reported at the site, 4D1, contains 4 phases, each with a hearth. One has far more artifacts, RMUs, and refitting sequences than the others, which, in theory, might be due to an unusually long occupation. However, the numerous lithics aren't matched by more animal bones or butchery, This makes it especially likely that there were instead more Neanderthals sitting around the fire, even if it was just for a night or so. Home design. Hearths are both chronological and spatial anchors in our understanding of how Neanderthals used their sites. They were the nuclei around which life happened, with everyday tasks made manifest as artifacts circling like electron halos. In evolutionary terms, hearths represent an important threshold, revealing the emergence of consistent patterns in how space itself was managed. Undoubtedly, some of this was based on practical considerations. Small or awkward spaces would limit choices, while the wood smoke in calculus at El Cidrón is a reminder that breathing in fumes was a regular risk. Even without knowledge of respiratory diseases, anyone who's experienced streaming eyes around a campfire understands that avoiding smoke is a good idea. Airflow models elsewhere hint at how the wider living space was used. This kind of analysis of level N at Abric Romani suggests that some hearths would have smoked out the rear area where Neanderthals slept, so they were probably only used during daytime. But beyond this, did Neanderthals have fireplaces as we understand them, remaking hearths in the same spot because of cultural tradition? This is very tricky to confidently identify. At Mandrin Cave, some of the soot archives deposited on the walls came from a series of hearths built in precisely the same place, front and centre of the shelter. But this may still have been chosen for ventilation. In other places, like Abric Romani, Neanderthals were raking out hearths between uses, albeit apparently within a single period of occupation. Equally, variations in burning intensities on hearth stones, shown by colour differences, might still form during one visit if the fire was used for varying purposes. Better evidence for true multi-phased hearths comes from thin intervening layers marking pauses in use that were long enough for natural sediment to cover the old ashes. This very likely reflects Neanderthals returning to Abric Romani after some time away, probably rather longer than a season, and choosing to light new flames inside a familiar hearth. Back at Abric del Pastor, the hiatus in time may be even longer. One of three hearths in level 4B directly overlies fire-reddened cobbles from a previous phase, potentially decades older. Whether or not the Neanderthals or their forebears had visited before, the stones were visible, and it would have been obvious that this was a place of old ashes and charcoal. That Neanderthals sat around hearths, perhaps generations old, is a striking image, redolent of how customs solidify into place. In sites with exceptional preservation, fragile traces also exist, showing how they were dividing up space itself. This implies pre-existing notions of correct areas for particular activities at both an individual and group level. Big sites that could, in theory, accommodate larger groups and longer occupations are most likely to be where splitting up of space happened. However, exploring this once again encounters the problem of proving that different zones in a site were used simultaneously. One of the best candidates is Abric Romani, but even using the RMU method, though shorter phases can be defined, the hearths within them can't be reliably separated. Moreover, refitting connections between different fires and activity areas are all one-directional and often concentrated in the top of the levels. This means that they're probably objects moved by later Neanderthals recycling old artifacts, and using lithics alone, there's nothing to say that the 60 hearths from the whole of level J, for example, aren't from 60 different visits. However, there's little point in recycling old dry fragments of animal bone, and these show a distinct difference in movement compared to other artifacts. While lithics tended to be carried inwards towards the hearth near the back wall, the faunal fragments almost all go sideways or outwards to the area beyond the roofline, as shown by refitting. Neanderthals were obviously using different areas for particular tasks according to the material. The more ancient level OB has been subject to full spectrum refitting and, translated from dry scientific description, the results are like a map allowing you to imagine dawn in a Neanderthal home 55,000 years ago, just after its occupants have left. Standing back against the rear wall, look down and your feet are surrounded by smashed up teeth, jaws and possibly skulls. The stone hammers and anvils that process deer, horse and aurochs still lie there. Straight in front of you, wisps of smoke rise from a large bonfire, in its ancient sense, fuelled by intensely burned butchery trash, obviously reused many times. As the sun rises to your right, it picks out a roughly circular mass of thousands of lithic and bone fragments, splintered detritus from final butchery stages, plus more hammers. A greasy smell suggests that cooking happened here too. The ground is compressed, many feet have walked here, tired legs folded to sit, and where children poked the ground with sticks, there are small pieces of bone pressed down into underlying deposits. Look to the rock shelter's margins. The ground is comparatively clear, but things have still been happening, and at the western side, there's the still bloodied skeleton of a cat, dragged spitting from its tree under last night's moon. Seeing such detail in how Neanderthals separated this space is remarkable, but it's only the beginning. The refitting of level OB also unveiled complex connections between different areas, though their meanings are tantalising. Fresh bone and lithic napping refits moved from the rear of the rock shelter to areas immediately adjacent, and someone carried a freshly shattered aurochs tooth right across the site. Even being conservative, the cumulative patterns point to at least two areas around here being active at the same time. Tracking by animal species is especially revealing. Aurochs and horse remains seem limited to the inner areas, although in slightly different zones, and microwear on their teeth suggests that they weren't being hunted at the same time of year. The aurochs look to have been taken over weeks or months covering an entire season, but in contrast, the horses were killed over a very short period, perhaps just a week or so. Since Neanderthals were certainly staying through at least two phases in level OB, it's not entirely clear how or if these two hunting patterns intersected. But if hunters were bringing in horses in rapid succession, maybe all at once, this would explain why their bones aren't evenly jumbled with those of the aurochs. It's highly likely that catching aurochs and horses required varying hunting strategies. Aurochs lived in smaller groups and didn't migrate, whereas horses may well have appeared seasonally in large herds. Could it be the same Neanderthal group doing all this hunting and just visiting Abrik Romani at different times across the seasons? One hint that this could be the case comes from the common use of the head-smashing corner and bone-burning hearth at the back of the site. Even though the remains clearly built up over time, the fact that all species were processed here is striking. Moreover, the shattered horse head parts aren't in quite the same spot as fragments of auroch skulls, which instead are found with head parts from red deer. It really looks like there were established places within the rock shelter where particular stages of butchery happened, and maybe even expectations of who did it. Rather than horse or aurochs, the most commonly hunted animals at Abrik Romani were deer, and they have another story to tell. Their remains are found all over the place, sometimes even in small zones without other bones, and come from across all seasons. Despite Neanderthals having comprehensively pulverised nearly all faunal remains in search of marrow, researchers were still able to pinpoint some parts belonging to individual creatures. They realised that within a bone scatter in the outer east edge of the rock shelter, there were parts from a single stag. But unlike the wildcat that had similarly stood out, the deer was strangely lopsided. Except some bits of antler and skull, there were only bones from the right half of the body. What was going on? In general, hunted animals at Abercromarnie reflect the typical Neanderthal pattern of bringing back only the richest parts, mostly limbs and some heads. The half a deer is therefore very unusual in having other body parts present, never mind located close together. One possibility is that the hunters had a lucky kill close to home and split the carcass immediately, either leaving one half behind or taking it elsewhere. Alternatively, the carcass was brought back whole, butchered, and possibly cooked in the outer area before the missing left side was taken to the bone fragmenting factories of the inner hearths, where it was rendered archaeologically invisible. Why did they leave the right half of the deer behind? It may be that, like the wildcat, this was a final hunt just before the site was abandoned, and they simply didn't need the meat. Whatever the real story was, the stag is exceptional proof that Neanderthals living here had a system for butchery, with successive stages happening not just in different places in the landscape, but also within sites. This complicated practice also implies sharing of tasks and food. And remarkably, there are hints that splitting carcasses was happening for aurochs too. Researchers identified that within the richest inner zone, many of the bones come from the right halves of four aurochs. In contrast, in a different area, every aurochs fragment that was identifiable by side came from the left. Deer and aurochs were more likely to be killed individually, so portioning out between the group, maybe to related subunits like families, would make sense. Fascinatingly though, the horse bodies show no such pattern and instead are widely spread across the whole rear zone. If herds were being hunted virtually simultaneously in seasonal terms, though not necessarily all the same year, then a predictable glut might mean there was more to go round, and entire carcasses were processed by different families. These are speculations to be sure, but they're entirely plausible scenarios based on everything else Neanderthals did. And while the pattern isn't identical, other places confirm that segmenting of space for carcass processing isn't unique to Abercromarnie or to large mammals. Meticulous mapping of bird remains at Fomane Cave uncovered that Neanderthals were butchering grouse and chough by tool and hand, probably cooking them, then leaving much of the body parts in a central dump. But something different happened to the wings. Some were removed whole, others were taken apart, skinned and sliced up, probably for tendons and feathers. But all of the wing waste was kept separate from the rest of the bird detritus and placed up against the east wall. This obvious division of tasks in the space of the cave suggests that different individuals were concurrently dealing with each butchery stage, creating their own trash piles. Furthermore, it must have been a practice repeated many times through the time span of that layer. Micro to midden. Reconstructing the minutiae of Neanderthals, moving things around and organising space, in essence, dwelling, is nothing short of extraordinary. But with the most advanced archaeological techniques, high-definition sites can go deeper and explore how Neanderthals' habits were worn into the ground itself. Over time, individuals going about their daily business compress floor sediments, compacting them into micro layers just a few millimetres thick. Their analysis is known as micromorphology, using resin-consolidated samples sliced super thin, then lit up under the lens like geological stained glass. The tiny structures within make it possible to anatomise the content of Neanderthal hearths and floors, based on comparisons with later prehistoric sites and experimental projects. By combining this technique with spatial data about hearths and activity zones, researchers were able to show that across the rock shelter at Abrikromani, there was as much diversity in floors as seen in Neolithic houses. Trampled layers were common, but not universal across the whole site surface. Areas with richer spreads of artefacts had micromorphological samples that pointed to more intensive use, and the converse was also true. This means that Neanderthals were using space in the same way over the long term. It was even possible to see how natural architecture, such as large stalagmites and built features, including alignments of limestone rocks, seemed to define boundaries between cleaner and messier areas. Micromorphology has also provided proof that, far from being slovenly, Neanderthals were regularly disposing of their rubbish. At Abrikromani, some samples taken away from hearths nonetheless showed a mélange of tiny bone and lithic fragments burned at different temperatures. They were most likely scraped up from inside and around fires, then dumped some distance away. Other rubbish samples were quite distinctive. Masses of mostly unburned, crushed bone and animal fats, plus coprolite, fossilised dung fragments, species unclear. These matched deposits surrounding particular hearths and likely reflect Neanderthals tidying up especially messy butchery waste and other waste. Most interesting, this cleaning was systematic. Some dump areas were multi-layered, clearly having been used repeatedly. Cave-proud Neanderthals were far from limited to Abrikromani. Lakonis is a collapsed cave in southern Greece, dating between 80 and 40,000 years ago. Its cemented remnants, today perched above the glittering Mediterranean, must be a contender for most picturesque dig site. Micromorphology here also found dump areas, and in this case, it looks like Neanderthals were intentionally burning butchery and food debris. Meanwhile, external ash dumps at El Salt were identified because they contained boxwood, which had only been burned in a couple of hearths. The most impressive evidence of Neanderthal housekeeping comes from Kibara. Along with a deep sequence of stacked hearths, it's famous for huge middens, trash heaps. Against the back wall was a pile of raked out ash, so large and thick it had to have built up over a long time period. Microscopic study of the apparently bare floor around hearths found masses of tiny bone splinters, confirming butchery had been going on. But the large waste had all been left in a big dump next to the ash heap. Something else truly unique was going on in the central area at Kibara. Three circular, densely packed accumulations of animal remains were excavated, the richest and largest about 1 meter or 1.1 yard across. It contained over 3,000 bones and thousands more small fragments, all embedded in a yellowish mass of minute bone slivers. Weird brown sediment halos around the bone circles appeared to have been stained by some sort of organic matter. How did these things form? Over centuries, it seems Neanderthals had been placing butchery and cooking waste in exactly the same spots. Yet the pieces in these circular features were smaller than those that went to the rear dump and came from meatier bits of the skeleton. The bizarre round features extended down at least 0.5 metres or 1.5 feet. But it wasn't possible to tell using the excavation methods of the time whether they were pits or some sort of structures Neanderthals slowly added to over time, with the surrounding layer building up around them. The brown stains also remained a mystery. although decayed offal might be a possibility. One last question. What did Neanderthals do with waste from their own bodies? The hominin dung in a hearth at El Salt has already been mentioned, and researchers took excavation here to a Lilliputian scale. Using a vacuum hose to filter sediment down to 1 mm, 0.03 inches, the hearth microstratigraphy was teased out. The burned black old occupation surfaces under the fire showed a triple-phased structure, with concentrations of tiny lithics and coprolite biomarkers more abundant at the top and bottom. It looks like Neanderthals had first made a fire when arriving, then swept the floor and burned the waste, which included old feces mixed with animal dung and plant material. This feels like a deep clean on moving into a home. But there's also evidence from Abricromani that bodily waste was routinely incinerated, along with grass and potentially moss, most likely old bedding. All manner of furnishings. The word bedding doesn't imply four posters, but nobody likes lying on hard rock. Today there's growing evidence that, as well as being particular about where they did things, Neanderthals were also concerned with furnishing their home spaces. At the Spanish site of El Esquilia, hearthside sediment included lots of whole phytoliths, microscopic mineral pieces of plants, especially grasses, which are made of silica and so resist decay. Some were still connected together and may have been remnants of some kind of thick, leaf-based pads. Something similar was also found around and within fires at El Salt, backing up yet more evidence from Abricromani. Neanderthals also wanted warmth and comfort when sleeping under the stars. About 20 years ago, construction north of Poitiers, France, uncovered a miraculously well-preserved campsite at the site of La Folie. Somewhere between 84 and 72,000 years ago, Neanderthals stayed by a river which shortly after flooded and left behind several metres of fine silts, ensuring what lay beneath was protected. The archaeological layer was just 10 centimetres or 4 inches thick, but extended over more than 10 metres or 11 yards and contained incredible detail. As well as hearths and lithic scatters, dark stains about a hand's breadth thick turned out to be decayed plant matter. Considering their thickness and location in a zone devoid of artifacts, the simplest interpretation is that this was a sleeping place. La Folie contained something even more astonishing. Surrounding all of the archaeological features was a roughly circular series of small, slanted pits, each ringed by limestone blocks. They contained traces of organic material and had compacted walls, and were the first clear case of Neanderthal constructions. By piecing all the evidence together, it seems that large wooden poles had been rammed into the ground, then secured with stone blocks. It's even possible to see how the stones collapsed inwards slightly when the poles were removed or rotted. This was clearly a built living space, providing both shelter, probably using hides lashed to the poles, and an enclosed home from home. The area is so large that it wasn't likely to be roofed, but there was probably one main entrance marked by a gap in the circle, with a hearth adjacent. Most interestingly, refitting shows that artifacts moved between different zones inside the structure. Even during a relatively short stay, Neanderthals were dividing up space. Napping was happening outside and around the inner edges, while the central area seems to have been for processing wood, vegetable matter, and skins. And just like in a cave, the bedding was directly opposite the entrance, up against whatever barrier was used, the farthest point from danger. The La Folie discovery wasn't the first claim for Neanderthal-built structures. But without modern excavation and analysis, there were many sceptics of things like the stacked mammoth bones at La Côte de Saint-Brélade. Other recent finds are, however, tipping the trend towards Neanderthal furniture of a sort. Around 70 kilometres or 40 miles south of Paris is a field called Les Bossats, near the village of Ormesson. In the 1930s, Upper Paleolithic artefacts made by Homo sapiens were tugged loose by ploughing, though not reported until 70 years later, which kicked off excavations. Beneath that layer, archaeologists found that Neanderthals had been there too, somewhere between 53 and 41,500 years ago. A fine covering of sediment meant that napping debris lay virtually where it had fallen, and in the richest area, four sizable sandstone blocks were found. They must have been hauled in from nearby deposits and were most likely useful surfaces. A fine covering of sediment meant that napping debris lay virtually where it had fallen, and in the richest area, four sizable sandstone blocks were found. They must have been hauled in from nearby deposits and were most likely useful surfaces, in other words, camp tables or chairs. Placed stone blocks or other large objects are known elsewhere. At Abric Romani, hearths have limestone blocks arranged around them, some acting as anvils for bone processing. One in level OB is located in the rear skull-smashing corner, and would have stuck up proud from the surrounding deposits, potentially explaining why this area was reused many times. The travertine at Abric Romani in other levels also preserved casts of massive pieces of wood. Fuel stocks is one explanation, but given the small branches in hearths, it may well be that there remains of structures. In level N, there's the entire tree trunk, and in level OA, a long, thick pole had been carefully trimmed of branches and bark. Both objects are positioned with one end towards the back wall, making feasible supports over which a shelter could have been formed. And, revealed in the side of a hearth, there's even a potential post hole, very regular and rectangular. Aside from bedding, micromorphology also indicates that Neanderthals didn't always squat above cold stone floors. Microlayers 0.5 to 2 millimetres or 0.02 to 0.08 inches thick at Abric Romani exactly match mat-covered floors in later prehistoric houses. Moreover, the state of the sediment just beneath points to non-porous material, rather than woven matting. Hides are most likely, and there's even minuscule remnants of probable burned skin in some samples. The mat samples come from next to hearths, including cooking areas, based on the presence of burned fats and bone splinters. Unexpectedly, some were located on top of butchery areas and even over dump sediments. Repeated successions of covered floors and disturbed sediment, full of plant remains, charcoal, and bone with different degrees of burning, suggest that the ground was cleaned in between phases when mats were used, perhaps at the start of occupations. And once more, there's evidence of long-term habits, since some of the same zones had covered floors in both levels JA and JB, representing at least many decades. While plant bedding would probably have been collected fresh for each stay, hide mats must have been transported and reveal Neanderthals carrying homely elements from place to place. Claims that Neanderthal use of space was thoughtless or random, equal to that of hyenas, are now truly obsolete. On the contrary, they were among the first hominins to create complex, intentional divisions of space, with a surprisingly familiar layout. Hearths are the stable cores around which both Neanderthals and archaeologists gravitate. They ignite our collective imaginations, summoning and illuminating the shadowy wraiths around them. Fires are time-travelling artefacts, a light. They stretched through days or even weeks, cold and buried, They're memorials for vanished bodies moving around them. The order in which they were used marks out when walls glowed or were in shadow. And sometimes time travellers emerge. Branches left smouldering when the site was abandoned, one unburned end sticking out as if the inhabitants had only just left. Hearths have long been like a single shared word between different tongues, easy to notice and understand, but set into the otherwise confusing noise of thousands of objects. But today, deciphering the wider material record of Neanderthal homes has become possible too. We can perceive long traditions of task areas, fixtures, and even soft furnishings. All this returns us to the question of who was at any given place and how long for. If Neanderthals organized their material world through fragmentation and accumulation, from individual napping sequences to the contents of entire sites, then it's plausible that their social groups were also dividing and coming together. Yet how this worked is tangled up with underlying patterns of subsistence, technology, and mobility. To truly grasp the system of the Neanderthal world, we must now look at a landscape scale.